Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
I'm walking along the seafront in Margate today. Does it sound different to you to my normal recordings? It's such a different sea. It's a bigger, wilder sea. It's not in an estuary mouth anymore, but of course it's on the sand too. But also when the tide comes in Margate, and that's kind of where it is now, it comes right up against the seawall. No beach at all. I love it, actually. Always feels that bit more powerful and potent around here. And every time I walk down here, I recite that T.S. Eliot line, "On Margate Sands, I can connect nothing with nothing," which is honestly probably one of the lines of poetry that I've thought about the most. Because what does he mean when he says that? Is it positive or negative? Is he talking about feeling empty, or is he talking about feeling empty, like in a glorious way? It comes within The Wasteland, which is this poem that on one hand talks about the terrible aftermath of the First World War and the dislocation that people felt. And that covers a lot of what's, you know, carried in the meaning of that line, doesn't it? That sense that you might feel emptied out by those experiences. And we do know that he came to Margate in order to recover from a fit of nerves during the sort of run-up to writing the poem. But also, The Wasteland covers lots of the ideas from the East that he was reflecting on at the time. He was understanding more about Tantra and yoga and some of the spiritual ideas that derive from Buddhism and the Vedic texts. And so, equally, in context, that line could be talking about the experience of nothingness that is spiritually meaningful and soothing and positive, or maybe both at once. Maybe that's exactly what that whole cycle captures. I love it anyway. I'm just pausing so you get a little bit more wave. There's a cormorant sitting out to sea on one of the posts that mark the height of the tide. Just watching him at the moment. So anyway, I wanted to introduce you to this week's guest, Joanne Lindberg, who's a good friend of mine. But I've been dying to find the right time to invite her onto the podcast to talk about her book, Letters to My Weird Sisters. I'll let you listen to how we unpack it in the podcast. But I just wanted to talk about how important it is to express our weirdness and our strangeness in the world. I don't think we always get it right when we talk about people who feel like outsiders. I don't think outsiders are always seeking to be made insiders or to have everybody accepting them even or feeling the same as them. I think instead we're often asking for our outsiderishness to be acknowledged and respected, for the periphery to be integrated into our understanding of the world as a valid place to stand. Anyway, it was a great conversation, and after we turned off the recording devices, we carried on chatting for ages until both of us had to go. And I always felt like, you know, I wish that like some of my best autistic girl buddies, as I'll call them, we don't call ourselves that, lived nearby, because I kind of feel like we could talk forever about our shared experience of the world and just spark off each other. Anyway, hope you catch a little bit of that in the podcast recording. I'll see you a bit later. Joanne, welcome to the Wintering Sessions. I'm delighted to have you here. It's really good to talk to you as obviously a fellow autistic woman. But I'm excited that your book, Letters to My Weird Sisters, is about to come out in the US as well, because I just think it's such a landmark book, not just for autistic people to read about autism, you know, as we love to laugh up.
Yeah.
But really for advancing the understanding of that quality of experience across time, like asserting how it's always been, rather than, you know, as we so often hear people saying, well, there were no autistic children when I was
There was just that weird kid, but that was different.
There was just the kid we threw stones at, but yeah. You know, like but also I think in the way that you assert a commonality again, like through different ways of being a weird sister, as you put it, like a, you know, an outsider, a different kind of a mind. And it's that solidarity that I think is really exciting about your book, because I don't feel that many people have really managed to nail that. And I think you have.
Oh, good. I'm delighted you think so, because it's all about commonality, community, solidarity and sisterhood. I just think, you know, so much a part of the autistic experience is feeling horribly alone and isolated and that you don't have community. So I think the most important thing to do is to create and foster community. And that isn't just something that you do across space, it's something that you do across time. And as I'm very clear, you don't have to diagnose people posthumously.
Yes.
You can look back and say, oh yes, I identify with these women. They had an experience like me. They are my weird sisters. And the other thing that was very important to me, and it sort of comes in the second letter to Adelheid Block, is to include those women who would be seen, who are non-speaking, people who use that kind of language and I don't would call low functioning, or people with intellectual disabilities, because they're so often excluded from solidarity. And I think that's dangerous for them and diminishing for the rest of us.
Yeah. And I think more than that, actually, not only are they excluded and othered and their humanity diminished, but also somehow they come to be used as a weapon against those of us who are autistic people, who can kind of take part in mainstream society. They're used as a kind of proof that we're not real and that our needs aren't valid.
Exactly. And I think we need to sort of have them with us and say, no, we're we're not the privileged autistics or the clever autistics or whatever you think we are. We're just all autistic, and our commonality comes from our shared way of perceiving and being in and experiencing the world. It's nothing to do with what you see or what you judge.
Yeah, so interesting. So, well, let's talk about this word weird, first of all, okay. And your claiming of it. What does it mean to claim being a weird sister? Why is that a useful term to take on?
Well, I think because it's non-clinical, for a start.
Yeah.
It's a term that I've chosen. It's not autistic or autistic psychopathology of childhood or whatever they used to call it, or Asperger syndrome or any of that, or developmental disorder. It's weird. This is what I am. And it's sort of taking back a word like queer or crip and saying, we're going to own this word and use it. And it like I said, it's a very broad word. So you could use it to encompass any idea of neurodivergence or even things that are not seen as neurodivergent. And you can take pride in it. And Fergus Murray, as you may have seen last couple of years, he's set up Weird Pride Day.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's a word we can use for ourselves. Hi, I'm a weird sister. I'm a weirdo. Me too.
Because it is. It's a word that, like, I feel like has so often been used against me, and I've overheard it or caught the kind of the feel of it. Mm. And it's one of those kind of states of being that as I've got older, I've been really glad to have, like, because I don't want to be the thing that is not weird. Like, that has got no appeal to me at all. And so therefore, maybe weird is actually a really luxurious space to inhabit.
Yes. Yes. It gives you room to be different and not to be easily definable, because it is a word that doesn't have a clear definition, and I kind of rejoice in that.
Yeah. And actually, thinking about the first addressee of one of your letters, Virginia Woolf, it kind of captures the state of those clever girls who should know better, who should be able to fit in better, but somehow don't. And people wonder why. Is that like a lack of will? Is that a deliberate standing at the sidelines? There's something in there for me.
Yes. And I was thinking just now about medicine in general, actually, and how the way it's taught is, here's a problem you can solve. And when someone comes with some rumbling chronic condition or some vague difference, it isn't a problem you can solve. And how do you feel towards problems you can't solve? You feel resentment.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the interview I did with Megan O'Rourke, talking about kind of undiagnosable chronic illness that nevertheless, like, affected every aspect of her life. You know, she said exactly the same thing, that her mainstream doctors wanted to be able to solve the problem. And when they couldn't, she became uninteresting to them, because they didn't have like a modality for working through a problem that they couldn't find a sort of straightforward solution to.
Yes, I've been uninteresting to doctors and uninteresting to psychologists as well in my time.
Yes, psychologists in particular, actually.
But I think the Virginia Woolf experience, that sense of exasperation around you, which you probably were familiar with as well, like, you're such a clever girl, there's nothing apparently wrong with you, why can't you just go out and be like everyone else and enjoy yourself like everyone else, and then you won't be a perplexity to us, and we won't worry that your life won't be the same shape as everyone else's, which is what we think it should be.
Yeah, and why don't you want this? I think that's the phrase that I heard so often. Not, I didn't hear it directly, but that's what I received. Like, why don't you want this thing enough that we want you to want?
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell us about Virginia Woolf's weird sisterhood, because it seems to me that so many people are really captivated by her, not necessarily even her writing, but her and her life.
Well, she was a very singular person, and some of that was intentional, but I think some of that she just couldn't help. And the Virginia Woolf I talk about is the one she talks about in her autobiographical writings that were written late in her life, but were about her life when she was Virginia Stephen, before she became Virginia Woolf, both literally and figuratively. And her mother died, her sister died, and she and her half-sister, and she and Vanessa were left in the house with three men, with their father, and their two half brothers, George and Gerald Duckworth. And George was very desperate to sort of make a figure in society. And obviously the assets you have for that are your beautiful, well-connected half-sisters. So he insisted on Vanessa dressing up and coming out with him. And then when Vanessa threw a strop and wouldn't do it anymore, he turned his attention to Virginia. And what was expected of her and Vanessa, actually, is that they would come down beautifully presented in the evening and either go out or receive at home, and that they would be pretty and charming and speak just enough about the right things. And Virginia couldn't do either of those things. Well, Virginia had this singularity about her. She also had quite a low income. So it was quite hard to turn herself out in the way that was expected. And she thought she'd found a brilliant solution, which was to buy some upholstery material, which was cheaper, and have it made up into a dress, which I think is great. It's the kind of thing I'd think to do, which is what, you know, really drew me to this story. So she put it on. She came downstairs to be inspected by George, and he looked her up and down and said, "Take that off and burn it." And not only did she not burn it, she described him in, you know, very, very, what's the word? derogatory terms years later. So I think in the end she won. So there's another story she tells from the same time. He takes her to see Lady someone or the Duchess of someone or the Honourable somebody. And she starts talking very enthusiastically about passion and platonic friendship between men and women. And there's this awkward silence. And this almost this sense of glasses breaking and cutlery being dropped. And afterwards he says to her, "They're not used to girls saying anything."
I just related so strongly to those stories. That sense of like bodily rebellion against wearing the right kind of dress and the incomprehension that there could be a wrong kind of dress, you know.
Yes, and also the incomprehension that why wouldn't you want to talk about this really interesting thing?
Yeah, I still have that incomprehension.
Why are you looking at me like that? Yeah, I'll always have that.
But also those environments that we've all ended up in where it seems like the rules are designed to catch you out, like they're not stated, they're not possible to follow. And you, of course, come a cropper somehow, because
yes,
how would you not? You know? Yeah, it was so, I guess I didn't really understand that she wasn't a complete insider, right? She always seemed like a insider to that very kind of posh world to me. And I could see suddenly how she wasn't.
Well, she's a very complex figure. She's both a well-connected, privileged, upper middle class woman and a woman who was weird and not of her place, and in some respects not of her time.
Yeah. And also who, you know, ultimately the weight of that strangeness in the world overtook her at the end of her life.
It did, yes.
That seems to be what we all most know about her, actually. That's the kind of, I don't know, the sort of iconic gesture.
Well, we know she was in pain. It could, you know, however privileged, you know, she was. We know she was in pain because of the way it ended.
Yeah. And I think it's such an image that she created in her own suicide, actually.
Yes.
She created something enduring that sticks in our imaginations.
Yes. She also wrote very well about awkwardness. And I've sort of tried to rescue the character of, I've totally forgotten her name, Doris Kilman in Mrs. Dalloway, who's sometimes just seen as a sort of victim of Virginia's snobbishness. Yeah. But actually, I think she holds Virginia's sense of awkwardness and humiliation.
Interesting.
Because I don't see how she could have written about that from the inside without experiencing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think once you break the assumption that Virginia Woolf is the ultimate insider, you realise how often she's writing about outsiders. And I mean, you know, Septimus struggling with his what we'd now call PTSD. Her books are full, and particularly her stories, actually, I think, are full of these.
Oh, yes, like Lapin and Lapin Over and so on. And the dress, there's a story I didn't have a chance to sort of reference in the book. I referenced it in an article called The Dress, about a woman going to a party and the horror of realising she's wearing completely the wrong dress. And she experiences herself like a fly in a saucer. The fact that she's wearing the wrong dress makes her feel like a fly that's dying in a saucer.
Do you ever feel like you're in the right dress? Because I don't think I've ever left the house and felt like I've worn the right thing, particularly in public.
Sometimes I do, because
you nail it, great.
Yeah, but because there's a certain kind of, you know, middle class white Cambridge woman, white stuff, and oh god, well, other brand names that I can dress up as quite easily.
I see.
But I'm aware that it both is and isn't a disguise. As a young woman, I got it wrong constantly. I could not do young womanhood. I do middle-aged Cambridge womanhood quite convincingly, but young womanhood I could not do.
I was much better at it when I was younger. I used to be really into vintage clothes, and like 40s and 50s vintage clothes. Mm. That gave me a way to construct something that was historically accurate and therefore complete in and of itself, you know, like it was something I could do. And I, you know, like you get older and it was, but also those clothes were really uncomfortable quite often. Mm. And it's really interesting to me that I endured that in favor of producing something that was consistent and understandable to me.
I'm just thinking about, you know, clothes as the equivalent of conversation.
Mm.
And sometimes clothes are making a statement, and sometimes they're monologuing, and sometimes they're saying the same thing as everyone else.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're not, and they're not meant to.
Mm.
But sometimes clothes aren't saying the same as everyone else's, people don't know what to say to you, just as they don't know what to say to you if you go to a dinner party and start talking about platonic love between men and women.
It's actually making a lot of the same statements, I think.
It is, yes.
But I remember this terrible, terrible moment when I was in the sixth form, and I was a school prefect, and we had to do all the kind of ushering at the church services and things like that.
Ooh.
We'd walk down the hill for. We got a really lovely badge though, which made it all worthwhile for me. I loved the badge. But I remember I turned up in this kind of crimpline suit. It was 60s, early 60s crimpline suit, dress and matching jacket. I was so pleased with it. I bought it in a charity shop.
Sounds lovely.
It was lovely. Blue crimpline, perfect, gorgeous. Nice little matching handbag. Now, however, I was being really bullied at the time by some girls in that school. They'd been incredibly mean to me.
Mm.
And as I was ushering people into the front row of the church service, the annual leavers church service, one of the girls walked up to me and just whispered in my ear, "That's my nan's suit. She died a few weeks ago and we donated it to charity." And oh, I love where you said fudge. Thank you for my very fragile podcast listeners. And I still don't know to this day whether that was true or not. You know, like I couldn't. One of the agonies of that moment was that I couldn't read it. Like as a,
but it doesn't matter whether it was true or not. She didn't say it because it was true. She said it because she knew it would cause you pain.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So you got the meaning loud and clear.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You couldn't miss the meaning. You know, like because I was kind of probably one of the poorest kids in that school. And it unpacked one of the meanings it unpacked was that it was evident to her that I was buying clothes from a charity shop and that was not okay as far as they were concerned.
You were ahead of your time with that.
I know it's so funny, but that, you know, they were all like in Benetton sweatshirts,
of course they were,
or Calvin Klein, or like that was the
Kukai. Was there the Kukai thing when you were at school?
Yes, there was. I mean, there was all sorts of like people with words on their t-shirt, which I never really got.
I've never understood that. I've never understood why you would want to give free advertising to the place you give your clothes from. But a lot of people seem very, the word that's on their clothes is more important than the clothes. I've never got
the clothes because they were always such plain clothes. Like I couldn't see any appeal to the actual clothes. It was anyway. That's just
that's just not us not getting it.
That's just us not getting it. But it was, I think that Virginia Woolf moment just really brought that particular thing back to me of not only feeling out of place, but it being pointed out to you in the cruelest possible way, so deliberately.
Yes. I mean, my moment was that, which I describe in the book, is when I was 14 and I found and still found tights uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I was still wearing white knee socks. And then it was made clear to me, not in a remark to my face, but in a remark between people in front of me. And possibly they didn't think I'd even notice, which is worse, that this was funny that this was a funny thing that was definitive of me. And I was so humiliated.
That's horrible.
Because at that point, until that point, I'd just been thinking about comfort, I think, mostly.
Yeah.
You know, I lost my innocence at that point. I thought, oh my goodness, people are looking at my clothes and reading them and judging them. And then there's another bit I talk about where actually this is probably the analogue of the Virginia Woolf green dress moment.
Yeah.
It was a sixth form again, you know, the kindest part of one's life.
Why do they let us wear our own clothes in sixth form, which is not ready?
I know. We're just not ready for the politics of it. And I was just walking home behind a pair of other girls and they didn't know I was behind them. I'm absolutely sure they didn't. And one of them was complaining about not getting a boyfriend. And then she said, I don't know what it is. It's not as if I dress like Joanne Lindbergh.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
And it's not that I don't think about clothes. I thought about them a lot and always do. So, you know, it's the point where if I watch the news on television, I get distracted by what the newsreader's wearing.
Yeah. But I mean, I find that I can't quite figure out certain outfits that I've never been able to figure out sportswear, for example.
No.
But other people wear sportswear and look great in it and look sporty in it. I just look awkward in sportswear, however I wear it, whatever I buy. Like, what is that? How do people understand how to wear these things? I don't know.
I honestly don't know. I can never get my hair right. I mean, I pay quite a lot to have it cut and coloured. So I'm reassured that it can't be going below a certain level because the person who does it's really good and that makes me feel better. But, you know, I've got this sort of flyaway, crinkly Jewish hair and I'm ashamed of it, partly because of internalised racism, partly because I feel it marks me out as someone who can't woman because I can't get my hair under control. This is not new, back to newsreaders, newsreader hair.
Yeah, I don't want newsreader hair though. Sorry, newsreaders, but I like my hair to move a little bit more than that, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, but I've really noticed there is a certain way you have to look in order to be in front of a camera. Not that I want to be in front of one. You've got to have the right teeth, the right makeup, the right hair, the right dress. You know,
I never have any of those.
No, me neither.
I mean, you brought up your Jewishness, and I love to talk about the weird sister whose Jewishness was part of the cruelty that was visited on her. Can you tell us a bit about her?
Yes, this is Adelheid Block. It's really a very, very horrible story. Adelheid was born to a prominent Jewish family in Lake Constance in, I can't remember exactly when, but she was about 30 when she died, so 1910s, I think. Mm-hmm. And then as a small child, she had what's sometimes called meningitis and what's sometimes called encephalitis, and it brain damaged her quite severely. And when she's described as not having much language and not having much control over her behaviour. And she's an intellectually disabled person. And a lot of her symptoms are, and obviously she wasn't autistic. She might have been as well. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they are not dissimilar to the traits that autistic people with higher support needs have ascribed to them. So she went as a teenager into an asylum. And then in 1939, something horrible happened in Germany.
Seem to be as a world busy forgetting, but, you know, that's...
Yes, I mean, the other thing we forget is it wasn't kind of an isolated thing that grew up in Germany. Because they were big on eugenics, and eugenics are a British invention.
Yeah,
taken up enthusiastically by the Americans and then imported back to Europe. So, you know, the first people to be sterilized were in America. But there were lots of laws by the time the Nazis came in Europe that allowed for the sterilization of disabled people seen as defective. This was not a German invention. So against the background of this, the Nazis come in. And all the asylums, the hospitals, the nursing homes are taken over. And basically the place where Adelheid is becomes a kind of research place for looking at degenerative heredity. Mm. So they're very interested in all the families of these people. And they're also interested in making sure they don't breed anymore. So first they sterilize people. And then they move into a phase which was called T4 after the address it was in Tiergarten in Berlin. That was where their headquarters were. And this was basically the precursor of the Holocaust. It was the slaughtering, the systematic slaughtering of people who were judged as having, and the phrase was, lives unworthy of life.
Yeah.
This is what's written on Adelheid's report, life unworthy of life, and also idiocy.
Mm.
So I thought, there's a causal relationship implied between those two. So I, in this chapter, I sort of explore the history of ideas of idiocy and imbecility or amentia or whatever horrible name you want to give to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the emergence of eugenics and what it means to be able to speak as opposed to not speak. And what happened to poor Adelheid was she was one of the first people gassed. She was taken to Grafenegg, which was the first killing centre for adults, because they started with children rather horribly, but then they moved on to murdering adults. And she was taken there and she was gassed in the early 1940s.
Yeah.
It's the most horrible story.
It's a horrible story on so many levels. And I'm really interested in your unpacking of the word idiot, because like it's a word that comes up so often in casual speech. And I don't think we realise the history of it actually.
I think I've stopped using it, but it's really hard to do because we use it all the time without understanding what it means, and that it was a word used to push people outside humanity and then physically kill them.
Yeah. And we've, you know, like I told my son about it after reading your book, and he started campaigning at school.
Oh, bless him.
Idiot.
Oh, that's
yeah,
lovely.
And he has done ever since. Whenever someone uses the word idiot at school, he makes the clear connection between autism and idiot, and how, you know, as an autistic person, he would have been labelled that and therefore would have been seen unworthy of life. But nevertheless, I think we're all still coming out with it sometimes. It's interesting how we kind of like having that word. That's a it's a dark insight into the self, isn't it?
Yes. I thought, what is... I mean, you want, certainly with many things that are going on at the moment, to have a word for something that is ignorant or foolish. Or, well, I'll say that something's foolish, because that, again, you know, the original term was natural fool or whatever. You know, an idiot is he that is a fool natural from his birth. But that seems long ago enough and somehow non-clinical enough to use. That was foolish behaviour. That was a foolish thing to do. That was the foolish policy. That was ill-informed, that was ignorant. I mean, there are lots of things you can call someone. You can just you could say you know you absolute plank, for example.
Actually, there's some really good English ones in particular. I think
twerp, you know, just call someone a twerp.
I mean, you could go for twat as well. Twat is
twat implies some kind of evil intention as well, doesn't it? But
oh, do you think so? That's interesting.
Also good. I have a friend, I think I talk of Karen Freeborn, who I talk about in the book, who used to call me a Muppet. You Muppet.
Muppet, yeah.
And I just, and I'm quite happy to confess to being a Muppet. It seems accurate. And it can be said affectionately as well.
Yes, Muppet. I think Muppet's a really friendly one.
Yeah, and for, you know, those of us who have autism and have, and that takes the form of dyspraxia, it fits pretty well.
Yes. I sometimes feel like I move a bit like a Muppet. You know? Like my whole body's like...
Yeah, me too. Like someone sort of withdrawn their controls and I've gone all over the place.
Yes, that's right. I hate it when other people say that about me. But yeah, I'm fully aware that that's also true.
Yeah.
I'm just interrupting you for a moment to ask if you'd consider subscribing to my Patreon. Friends of the Wintering Sessions get an extended edition of the podcast a day early, the chance to put questions to my guests, a monthly bonus episode, and exclusive discounts on my courses and events. Most of all, you help to keep the podcast running. To find out more, go to patreon.com/Catherine May. Do take a look. Now back to the show.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
You know, what kind of what comes out in your book is something that I guess we know already, but that we maybe forget to state, which is this link between othering and cruelty.
Yeah.
You know, and an infliction of suffering. And yeah. I thought that about Katharina Kepler as well. Excuse me.
Yes, because one thing that happens is that social death can often precede actual death, being murdered, being put outside society, being put in an asocial space or a less than human space.
Kind of outside the walls, as it were, almost.
Outside the walls, yes. And Katharina Kepler was the mother of Johannes Kepler, the early modern astronomer and mathematician, which, and we'll come to this, is what saved her. And she lived in the German town of Leonberg. She lived actually not awfully far away from where Adelheid died. It's a funny thing.
Yeah, there seems to be almost a connection between the two in your, an implied connection somehow.
Yeah, almost, yes. And she was the oldest woman in town. She'd been on her own ever since her husband deserted her. So in a time where femininity was, there were overtly strict standards of femininity. You were supposed to speak quietly and as little as possible and be sensitive and emotional and weepy, all the things we now ascribe to white womanhood, that sort of thing. And she was not, I mean, she couldn't be, because as her son pointed out, she had to take over the business of everything. She had to assert herself in the public realm because there was no one to do it on her behalf. There was no man to be a proxy, as was more approved of.
Yeah.
And there were also things about her, the way she's described, was she was very much not that kind of soft woman. She had opinions. She would state them. If she thought you were wrong, she would correct you. And she was very direct. She was very assertive. She wasn't very aware of, I guess, what we now call social cues.
Yeah.
So she doesn't seem to have seen if it was not a good time to approach someone. She would just go in there anyway, which I can relate to. And she, and one of the things that was said about her in court was she doesn't make eye contact with the jury. That's weird. And I thought, And her son said, well, my mother doesn't. My mother talks across people and says what she has to say. And I thought, okay, that sounds
interesting.
Very familiar. And also that she had this woman had a son who was an astronomer and a mathematician.
Yep.
Yeah.
There's that genetic link that we know about with autism that comes up again.
Yes. So she wound up being accused of witchcraft, and there was a very long, drawn out procedure. She was out of town. She was back in town. She was put in prison in irons. And then she was finally, there was a final hearing, and it's her son's meticulous notes for this final hearing that we have, which enable us to know who she was and that she had a life and that she existed, because she herself was illiterate, as most women were. And he managed, just by being utterly meticulous, to get the charges thrown out. But this was after years of suffering. She died not long afterwards. She was an elderly woman, and the stress.
She was kept in terrible conditions, wasn't she?
She was kept in horrible conditions, literally in chains.
Yeah. And I mean, it says something that this influential man was what it took to get her out of it. And even then, it wasn't straightforward.
No, it wasn't straightforward at all. I mean, it was his exceptional, I think, gifts and his conscientiousness and his determination. And it is a very touching story in a way, because he speaks about her sometimes in a very disparaging way. She obviously drove him absolutely up the wall. You can see that, not even between the lines, you can see it in them. But, he valued her and loved her enough to take all that time out of his life and devote himself to that. And I think that's the lovely aspect of the story.
Yeah, and also, what a precise brain can do, actually.
Yes.
It's the moments when those incredibly detail-oriented brains come into their own when it's unpicking a case like that.
Yes.
But it's that link, it's that chain reaction that I think is so invisible that, you know, when you and I talk about outsidership and how it feels to be socially rejected, perhaps when we're young, you know, perhaps we are more in the centre of things now.
Yes.
But that kind of chain reaction between that and a threat to your life, which actually seems far-fetched but isn't. Like, we know that at times of war, at times of civil unrest, at times of big social change, that the outsiders are suddenly at huge risk.
Tell me about it being Jewish right now.
I think that's what we see all over the world as soon as life becomes fidgety.
Yes. And I think I talk about in the Adelheid book, and there's a word, necropolitics, the politics of death, who gets to live, who gets to die. And sometimes you see them played out very literally, as in Nazi Germany, and sometimes you see them played out more insidiously, as in only people with underlying conditions died, few.
Mm.
You know,
well, and quite overtly, yeah, for autistic people at the beginning of the pandemic, when some NHS trusts put blanket do not resuscitate signs,
yes,
on
exactly,
autistic people.
Yes, and people with intellectual disabilities.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we have lives unworthy of life by definition.
Yeah, and suddenly...
Oh, it just makes you shudder, doesn't it?
It does make you shudder, because in an age when, you know, we've all been pursuing this identity, and it's been so helpful to us to come to that understanding. You know, and we've been seeking out that label.
And we found each other.
And we found each other, and it's been life-giving and so... it's been everything to me. It's been survival to me to understand autistic. But it could also... It suddenly made me remember how risky it is to also do that. It's not...
Yeah. I mean, I don't always declare myself...
No.
I mean, certainly if I go into a medical setting, I don't think it's on my records, I don't know. But I don't always mention it.
No.
And that's a shame, really.
Well, yeah.
I mean, not in the current situation. The current situation, if you're able, sometimes masking is about survival.
The massive privilege of masking, honestly.
Massive privilege of masking. But yeah, also it means you have to suppress parts of you.
And
you can't, you know, you can't actually communicate your experience, because you're using a language designed not to give away how your experience makes you one of them.
Absolutely. And we are engaged in that dance all the time. You know, every time we need to access some form of help. And whenever I've disclosed, I think I've rarely had a good outcome. Except I was telling you, wasn't I? Because we talk on WhatsApp sometimes, and I was,
yes,
telling you that in my recent visit to Sweden, I went to take part in a podcast, and the host said, "Oh, you're autistic. Should I turn that overhead light off?" And I almost welled up with the consideration, because, you know, genuinely, I don't think most people would know that fluorescent light is such an issue for loads of autistic people.
Mm.
But also, I'm so used to just dealing with the fluorescent light. Like, you know, in my own home, yeah, I have all the lights low, but when I'm out, I get used to just dealing with it and I don't even notice.
I'm not too bad with light, but I'm very sensitive to noise. And
right.
I was in a big dining room yesterday, was very echoey, and I suddenly realised, I thought, I don't just want to know, this hurts me, this is hurting my ears to be in this room.
Mm.
And I almost wished I hadn't allowed that into my consciousness, because it then became, yes, very hard to stay in there. And you realise how much you suppress, how much physical discomfort and emotional discomfort and fear and confusion and pain you are pushing down all the time. And it feels almost dangerous to acknowledge it.
Yeah. And then you wonder why you're exhausted when you get home. And it's because you've
all
been...
of that.
Yeah.
And all, yeah, the, you know, conscious reading of the people around you that you've, I've done it for so long that it is second nature, but it's still involving an effort in my brain that I assume most people don't have to do. And it's exhausting.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
I think of it as room, I call it my room dyslexia. So it takes me, I can read the room, but it takes me longer. It takes me an effort and I'm tired afterwards.
Yes. And if it's noisy, and if people are standing close to me or it's hot, then I am significantly less likely to be able to actually do that reading, to be honest. And I will spend the next 12 hours replaying it moment by moment in my mind over and over again to the point of absolute insanity.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
We need to begin to think about closing this. But I wanted to ask really about the way that you intertwine your own story with the story of these different women. What did it mean to you to make that deliberate connection and to actually speak to them directly and kind of share your story with them? It feels like an intimate conversation in places, the book.
Well, I wanted that intimacy. It's a book about connection. It's not a book that's making a psychological assertion about someone. It's a book that it's expressing a sense of connection and bringing people into the fold and making your fold bigger. And I didn't want to write about them, or I didn't want to write for them. I was especially aware with Adelheid that when you've got someone who's non-speaking, then the temptation is to speak for them. And actually, maybe I'm being very little. Don't get me wrong, people advocate wonderfully for their relatives and for their clients who can't speak. You know, there are people doing a wonderful, loving job out there. Mm. But what you can't do is speak for that person.
Yeah.
So I thought, I can speak to you, though.
Yeah.
And I can give this letter to you as a gift, and what you do with it and whether you can do anything is with you. But it's an expression of solidarity. It brings us back to the beginning, I think. Yeah. And also, I was very influenced, I should say, by a book by Georgina Clegg called Blind Rage. It's a brilliant book. She's a blind American scholar.
Right.
Among other things, she's legally blind and started to go legally blind as a child. And Blind Rage is a series of letters to Helen Keller. And it's partly a biography of Helen Keller. It's partly about Georgina's own experience. It's partly a reckoning with the figure of Helen Keller, who was held up as kind of, you know, patron saint of deaf blind people. This is how to be a good disabled.
Yes. Watching the film about Helen Keller is, I think, one of my first brushes with, a discourse about disability as a child. Mm. It's an early informational text that goes out there to say, this is and how you should do it.
Yeah, and it's given us something to overcome. Mm. She wasn't human, now she is.
Yes.
Is the kind of message of the story. I mean, she was actually a very sort of complex figure and far more interesting than the sort of saint that's been created out of her.
Yeah.
But Georgina writes to her because she is reckoning with her. And the other thing is, and I think I said this in the letter to the reader, which is the only letter to the reader, I was thinking about how, you know what, I'm not masking, I'm not adjusting myself for you. This is not yet another book of me explaining myself to you. Screw that.
Yes.
I'm going to have a chat with my friends over here and you can listen, but you can come to where we are.
Yeah, which is, again, more liberating than it should be, but definitely liberating.
I know. I mean, I was thinking analogously of, I was thinking of Beyoncé's album Lemonade. And I don't understand.
Few people would compare you to Beyoncé.
I wouldn't compare myself to Beyoncé. I wish in so many ways. But I was listening to Lemonade and there are bits of it I don't understand. But that's okay because it's not addressed to me.
Yeah.
I can listen if I like, and I'm grateful for the privilege of listening. But I have no right to demand that it's completely accessible
that
to me.
It's made into a text for you.
Exactly.
Than,
it is not a text for me.
Yeah. And that's so hard, I think, culturally. That I think that's part of this cultural moment we're in, that we're finding very hard, is that not everything is for you as the, you know, imagined kind of like
default
mainstream
person.
White
viewer.
Yeah, like which has become the default, that the cultural we is the kind of white middle class across loads of different societies.
Yeah, and you as well are in a strange space of both being the cultural we and not being it.
Yeah.
So we know both what it's like to not realise that we're centering ourselves, and we also know what it's like to be in different contexts, to not be in the centre, to be the they instead of the we.
Yeah.
Because this is how I explain it. I say, who is the we and who is the us here and who is the they? And if someone's the they, like the most vulnerable in our society, they're always the they, you've got a problem.
Yeah. It's so interesting being invited into the sort of cultural centre, having not been in it before, because even then I often come out feeling spoken over about my own experiences, you know. So where I'm asked about my autism, the reply is often telling me back about how I should conceive of it, rather than simply absorbing what I have said about it.
And I think the success of Wintering, you know, it was a brilliant book, but also a lot of people, a lot of non-autistic people, wider people, felt they could identify with it.
Yes.
So I'm sure you've thought about this a lot, but then they've got to try and negotiate with the fact that you're like them, but not like them.
Well, yes and no, because actually I find that a lot of people just skip over that information. I mean, I kind of drop it in the first few pages of the book, but I don't go into
That's what I figured they'd do. It's like, we don't really want to think about the implications of that.
Yes, that's right. Or, of course, I mean, like the human mind is profoundly confabulatory. It will make up a story to...
It is. I mean, what I think I find so impressive about Wintering is it's something I don't think I could do, which is put myself in a place where most people could identify with me. I'm such a committed weirdo, for better or worse. And I don't think it makes you less weird or less autistic or less unique. Just somehow you've managed to find a bridge.
Yeah, but that bridge really surprises me, because actually I feel like I wrote a book about the kind of gloomiest, weirdest part of myself, you know, all the bits that are normally, you know, all the bits that have attracted that comment that we talked about at the beginning before, like, why don't you want to be like everyone else? Why do you have to dwell on these things? Why are you obsessed with death and, you know, that kind of thing? Like, that book is full of all that stuff, honestly.
But one thing you realise is that even people who, you know, are totally at the centre, in a way they don't think about, they also have moments where they think about themselves as outsiders.
Yes.
Or there are always bits of themselves that they have to leave outside the circle because they don't fit in order to... Like when David Bowie died. Now, you can't have that many people who were really that weird and only ever identified with David Bowie. I mean, I'm sorry, but speaking as someone who has always been weird and can't help but be weird, if you can put weird on and off, you're not weird.
Yeah, absolutely. You're like weird like a stick of rock all the way through.
Or exactly. Or you're cosplaying weird. Yeah.
I love the idea of cosplaying weird. But, you know, like, in my own world, I don't feel weird at all. I feel like everyone else is weird. So while I always feel like an outsider, I also feel like my center is the truth, you know, in that very arrogant human way. Like, I find other people's willingness to like obey social norms and wanting to be part of a pack and, you know, wanting to look the same in those Benetton sweaters or whatever it is. I find that weird. Like, for me, that's weird.
I find it weird too, but also I think I've really successfully internalised a lot of shame and fear about not being part of it. So I never feel able to assert most of the time that I'm the one that's got it right. I always know. I always have this sense, well, you could be wrong. You could be completely wrong. Yeah. And it's permanent. I'm never, what's the word? The phrase that's coming to my head is, I'm never quite in my skin. Maybe that'll do.
Yeah, you're always conscious of wearing whatever it is you're wearing at that moment and how contingent that is on.
And it might be wrong. You might have put on, you know, the wrong face today.
Thank you, Joanne. That was just such a great conversation about weirdness.
It's always great to talk to you.
I know. It's lovely to talk. I could unpack outsidership forever, actually, because I think it's this huge and complex experience.
And I wouldn't say it's not something everyone experiences, because it's contextual. So almost everyone will have experienced it at some point. I think if there's a bridge, that's the bridge.
Yeah, that's kind of lovely, isn't it? That's an optimistic note to end on, that maybe.
I think so. Let's end on an optimistic note. Yeah, we need optimistic notes.
More optimism. More weirdness, more optimism. Thank you.
Thank you.
You bought what we needed today.
I don't know if it's because I've made it a little bit further along the coast as I've been walking and talking to you, or if the sea has genuinely calmed down, but you can hear probably the much more serene quality of the sea at this point on the path. It's just lapping up gently against the seawall. I always think a lot about the smell of the sea. Loads of people hate it. I love it. I love the smell of the sea. It is today intensely green. It's like the smell of the roots of flowers when you pull them out of a vase. Hopefully before they've gone slimy. Maybe that's why people don't love it. I'm beginning to understand now that this might be my particular thing. It's funny because as I'm walking along here, I'm feeling strange all over again. I'm sort of turning my back from the people who ride past on their bikes because I'm, you know, talking into a big furry microphone. It's weird, isn't it? It's a weird thing to do. But so many of the things worth doing are weird and they do make you appear to be weird. I think a lot about how the progress of my life and all the best things that have come to me are from leaning into weirdness rather than trying to hide it. I think Joanne's completely right that reclaiming weird is our birthright. I hope some of you and all of you felt as relieved by that conversation as I did. Do you know what? As I carry on through life, I understand more and more that everybody feels like an outsider in one way or another. I don't know anyone who genuinely feels like an insider, even the people that look like insiders to me. Everyone's always busy identifying their difference and often feeling sort of challenged and victimised by that. And of course, for loads of people, that victimisation is very real. But I do think it's an interesting exercise to identify the places where our outsidership is to some extent chosen and to some extent a luxurious space where other people don't have control of us. A rebellious space, a creative space, a generative space. I don't want too much insidership. I like it. I like it on the edges here. Just like I like being right on the edge of the sea. I'm walking along a part now where the graffiti artists have taken over. And there's sand up on the path. It feels like this is a liminal space outside of the main constraints of the town. I wouldn't want to be here on my own at night, but here in the daytime, I don't know, it fits. I'm wishing you all a good week after you've listened to this. I wanted to say thank you again to Joanne and to producer Buddy, who I met with for lunch last week and completely failed to get a photo of us together. But he does so much for this podcast and it was great to see him. Everything happens remotely, doesn't it? We don't get to meet in person. And thank you to Megan, our convener. I talked about her role last time. And thank you to the Patreons who just showed me the best time last week when we did a live book surgery on Patreon. Had so much fun talking about the books we love and the books we need at this point in time. I spent ages researching it beforehand as well because I was scared that they would all laugh at me because they're all so knowledgeable. So it was good. It was good for me. And I'll see you all again really soon. I've got some amazing guests coming up for you. And if you want the chance to feed in questions to them, I'll ask after I've done the main interview, then do join the Patreon. My patrons are enjoying a really good extended episode this time, and you could too. And it really, really helps to keep us afloat. Thank you, everyone. I'll see you soon. Bye for now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.